You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. What is technology doing to us? How does it affect our ability to work, to be present, to connect to one another? Podcaster Aliyah Tavakolian wonders about these things all the time, and tech journalist Bob Sullivan has spent his life finding the answers. Their new podcast, So Bob, is your opportunity to ask, So Bob, how can I live a better digital life? Follow So Bob on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And now, on with the show.
Your name's Ronnie Proxen, right?
Uh-huh.
Don't freak out. I've been sent here to kill you. I'm not gonna do that. Calling an audible right now. I go, okay, so I want you to drive to Chicago and I need you to stay there for about a year. Do you have a suitcase?
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was Bill Hader as a hitman with a crisis of conscience in season 2 of HBO's dark comedy series, Barry. Since debuting to critical acclaim last year, Barry has steadily grown its loyal following and earned 4 Emmy Awards, including an Emmy Award for Best Actor in a Comedy Series to Hader himself. For him, the show, which he co-created and stars in, is more than just an opportunity to explore a darker, more nuanced character than fans might be used to from his time on Saturday Night Live and movies like Superbad and Trainwreck. It's a return to his first love, filmmaking, and the fulfillment of a lifelong dream to be a director. And if there were ever any doubts about his abilities behind the camera, they were blown away by this season's episode 5, which followed the much-anticipated Battle of Winterfell and immediately had audiences talking. And today, Bill Hader joins me on the podcast to talk about everything that went into that brilliantly cinematic episode of Barry, including how he choreographed a nearly 30-minute-long fight scene and why he had to hire a construction crew to build him the perfect tree. He reminisces about his childhood love of film, his early days in Hollywood as a struggling production assistant, and the happy accident that led him into improv. Then Bill Hader recalls his original audition for Saturday Night Live, a few of his favorite obscure impressions from SNL and his IFC show Documentary Now, and some strange advice he got from Lorne Michaels about not being Bill Murray on a boat. He shares what he learned about story from his days in the writer's room on South Park, how he manages to walk the line between comedy and darkness on his new series, and how his love of cheesy true crime shows like Forensic Files and Snapped come in pretty handy on Barry. Coming up with Bill Hader in just a moment. Last year, SNL alum Bill Hader surprised audiences with the debut of his dark comedy series Barry on HBO, earning him 4 Emmys, including an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series. Now Barry is back for a second season, and it just keeps getting stranger, funnier, and darker all at once, just like its creator and star, Bill Hader. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I have been such a big fan of yours going back to SNL days, and of course, Documentary Now, which I think is so, so underappreciated, and people definitely have to tune into IFC and see that. But Barry is so brilliant and so next level. For anyone who hasn't seen the show, let me just tell them, your character Barry is a hitman from Ohio who makes his way to LA and decides to kind of have a midlife crisis and pursue acting. Part of the pathos of this show is watching that familiar plight of the aspiring actor trying to navigate his way through the movie business. Now, I understand that you had a similar experience early in your career, except for you, it wasn't necessarily acting early on. It was actually trying to become a director. When you came to Barry, did you draw on some of those memories of being a struggling artist yourself trying to break into the business?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I moved out here in 1999, and what I wanted to do was direct, and I made a little short film, and pre-internet, pre-everything, it was VHS tapes in a box in my car, and and then I was just too shy or just felt weird. If you saw someone famous or you met somebody of giving it to them, I just felt weird doing that.
You didn't have that boldness or bravado. Leaving scripts in people's cars.
Oh my God, no. And now I'm happy I didn't do that because I know it's a weird turnoff. But it's a weird catch 22, of coming out here and then finding a community of a bunch of other struggling artists who are all transplants and all, you know, nervous and full of hope and dreams, but also, you know, weirdly competitive and, you know, the whole thing. And so it was just an interesting time that I could relate to. But instead of just making a show about that, I wanted something that had like real stakes to it. So made him a hitman.
Now, you're well known as a cinephile and you love movies going way back to, I think, your childhood in Oklahoma. And by the way, you have the least Oklahoma accent of any Oklahoman I've ever met, including my uncle.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where that accent comes from.
I know. I have just kind of like a weird, whiny Midwestern accent. But yeah, it's not... My favorite thing was someone tweeted, Bill Hader can do any voice. Why does he choose to speak with that one? And I was like, oh, man, that's pretty good. Massive cinephile. Loved movies from a very young age. Was really drawn to them and became very kind of obsessed with seeing everything. You know, you'd watch something and then I'd read about them and hear about other filmmakers and go, well, I gotta go find these movies. And again, to show my age, before internet and streaming and all that, you had to really, you know, pray that you would go into a video store and those movies that you were looking for were in there. And if they weren't, you're just kind of shit out of luck.
Yeah.
And there was
and
no
Blockbuster didn't cover a lot of the movies that you and I probably were looking for.
No, not at all. Yeah. And so I remember going to New York for the first time when I was 18 and just the excitement of going into video stores there and knowing, oh, I bet they have these movies that I've been looking for forever. And I bet they're all in there. Or I remember trying to find the Polanski's movie, The Tenant, was one I was wanting to find forever because I loved Rosemary's Baby so much. And then Albert Brooks' movie called Real Life was another one that I just, because I liked Albert Brooks from his SNL shorts and things like that. And so it was always this hunt to find, you know, you would get it in Tulsa. There was a place called Sound Warehouse where they would have like Aguirre, Wrath of God, and 8½, and and those things, but that was it. That was the only Herzog or only Fellini or whatever. And so, it wasn't until DVD that I saw, you know, Enigma, Caspar Hauser, or any of these other great, really great Herzog films, or any Fassbender movies, or anything like that. And then any of the Russian films. I mean, Criterion has just been a godsend for me as a film fanatic of, oh, wow, cranes are flying. I just saw that movie for the first time like 6 months ago and was like, how have I not, this thing's amazing. How have I not seen this, you know? And for this new season of Barry, it's so funny how this works out, but
I really liked these Polish films. There's like that Polish new wave in the 60s, especially the movies Andrzej Wajda and Canal and A Generation and Ashes and Diamonds, of course. And there's a Criterion and a box set of those. So I'd watch those, and those really influenced how I was shooting this season, my stuff.
I can kind of see that, yeah.
And then you shoot it, and people go, oh, wow, it looks like the Coen brothers, or it looks like Steven Spielberg, and you go, oh, okay, I guess, great. You know. And I'm like, you sure it doesn't look like Andrzej Wajda? And they're like, no, you know, it looks like, you know. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's just funny, yeah. You know. Or it just looks like an episode of television. You try so hard to make it interesting and different. And,
yeah.
You know, from the lens sizes or what your coverage is, or limiting your coverage is a lot of it. You know, you sit there and you try to make a thing interesting and different, and it always ends up just being like, you know, yep, that's an episode of television, you know. And I realize that the first season.
Barry is, though. When I look at the episodes together, I mean, it seems almost like a season is either a long movie or two movies.
Yeah, that's true in the writing sense. I always felt our first season got better visually, and we were kind of finding our footing. You know, I directed the first three, and the pilot's all right. Two and three, I felt like if I did them again, I would do everything differently. Just a lot of it's just confidence and, you know, being in charge of a bunch of people and those things, but I was happy this season. I directed this episode, Ronnie Lilly, about the Barry has a hit that goes wrong. And that was almost designed to be kind of like a weird bottle episode solely so I could just tell it in a really cinematic way. And it was so hard to do it when you have 30 minutes and you have to kind of, you have all these storylines and all these things happening. So
that episode, which you also directed, holy shit, man, that fight scene just kept building and surprising, and it was just so tight. I almost think that it could have stood on its own as a short film.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, no, it was fun making that. I mean, I that was a very rare episode where I kind of wrote it outside of the writer's room and then kind of presented it to them. Like,
okay,
I just, you know, on the board, it was like episodes 1 through 4 and then episodes 6, 7, and 8. And then in episode 5, it would just said, you know, Ronnie Proxen, hit goes wrong, you know. And I just was like, I'll pitch this to you guys. And then the room did help with they came up with the super glue to the hands. We came up with that in the room, you know. But a lot of the other stuff, it was just kind of, it was fun to write something and just intuitively follow it instead of like trying to control it or need to say, well, this is a thing that has to pay off later or whatever. Just having an episode where, you know, I'm writing it and Barry goes into, okay, so he's going and talking to the guy and he goes into his room. What if the room is filled with Taekwondo trophies? You know, oh, that's interesting. What if they get in a fight and then he gets nunchucks out, but then he can't do the thing? You know what I mean? Purposely or subverting it while you're writing it, because you're like, well, anything right now would be the fight would continue.
Right.
Well, what if it didn't continue? What if he, you know, just goes and then it's like, well, why? Oh, what if he broke his neck? And then I go back and go, okay, so he breaks his windpipe. That's why, you know, and it's like, it was a fun, it was very liberating. Writing that, you know.
Yeah, and it was fun to see this, like, sociopathic master killer sort of have the tables flipped on him for the first time.
Yeah, exactly, where he's, he's trying not to do it.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's trying very hard not to kill anybody. He comes in with this really half-assed plan to let him go to Chicago for a year, and I don't have the money or anything, but I think we could figure that out, and the guy agrees to it, which is funny. Because he knows, well, I'm just going to kick the shit. I'm going to kill you, you know? So Alec Berg, the co-creator, was helpful when we talked about it because he said, it's so easy to just make this all a fight scene, but we should try to have some emotional thing in it. So I went back and thought about it, and I was like, oh, what if we had these kind of daydreams, these like fever dreams that Barry has, you know, about coming back from Afghanistan and Fuchs being there and trying to not be didactic with it, just try to tell it in images and it's a testament to HBO so that they let us do it.
Oh, yeah. That episode aired immediately after episode 3 of Game of Thrones, and I have to say, I honestly think Barry was the bigger payoff, because audiences tuned in for the Battle of Winterfell with such impossibly high expectations, and then here you come, so stealthy, with no hype, no build-up, and you deliver this epic and epically absurd episode-long fight scene. When you were mapping out season 2, were you conscious of the fact that this episode was going to have the most anticipated hour and a half of television as its lead-in?
No, we had no idea. Okay. We didn't know about it until that week.
Oh, really?
Because we got invited to this screen of the Battle of Winterfell at Man Chinese, this four-year consideration event, and it was this massive, you know, all these people came out.
What a great place to see that.
Yeah, so we went to Man, and people from the show were there, but also the guys, the Stranger Things guys were there, Vince Gilligan was there, like all these kind of other people who just, you know, run other shows who are just fans of Game of Thrones were like, oh, we got to check this out. And I just was like, wow, this thing is mammoth, and just thinking, no one's going to be watching Barry after this. But then it was nice. Yeah, we got our biggest audience, you know, after that. I mean, we got the numbers, and I think it was like 2.4 million extra people watched the show, and it was like, Jesus.
And it paired nicely, I think.
You
had the Battle of Barry following the Battle of Winterfell.
Yeah, and it was funny that we both had little girls stabbing guys, jumping on guys and stabbing them. When I saw that, I was like, oh, man, what are the chances that we both have a little girl jumping on top of a guy and stabbing him?
And by the way, to your credit, I haven't heard any complaints about the lighting on Barry on the episode.
did people complain about the lighting?
So many people were saying that the Battle of Winterfell was too dark. But then the cinematographers were saying that's because you guys weren't watching it in the right environment. You and Man Chinese probably had the intended environment.
watching
it on TV
with lights on and stuff. Yeah, I see. Yeah, yeah. No, I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, I don't know about that, but the Dave and Dan, the guys who do that show, were really great and really nice guys, and they sent me and Alec really nice text afterwards, and we said, well, thank you guys for giving us massive numbers. I mean, Jesus, how lucky are we to be following the biggest show on television?
Yeah. How hard was it for you to direct that episode? How complicated was that episode?
I was very lucky that Aida Rogers, the producer, read it, and she built into her schedule an extra hiatus week. You know, I photo boarded the entire thing because we have no time really to shoot. And we had overhead schematics. I mean, we just planned it to an inch of its life.
A lot of pre-pro.
Yeah. And, you know, Wade Allen had shot, you know, we went in and said the long take of the fight. I said, you know, this is what I'm thinking. And so he choreographed it so it would play out for that specific camera angle. So it was an interesting thing of you almost came with the camera shot first. You know, his thing was the camera was following them the whole time, and that's kind of how I was thinking. And Paola actually said, well, what if they go out of frame and we're kind of, that makes it a little less of an action scene and a little bit more like we're kind of observing it and we're almost kind of judging it in a weird way. And that's a great idea. And then that influenced so much of the episode.
Yeah.
We were kind of like, what if it's just this kind of weird, we've just plopped you in there, and this from the point of view, we're just letting you observe these people, this crazy situation he's in, but it's also this feeling of, look at these people, I know this sounds so highfalutin, but these people on Earth and what they're doing to each other.
Yeah.
The eye purposely, of God. Eye of God type of feeling. We're going to go in like, isn't that interesting that, but I would never, I had all the ideas, but having those collaborators there to plus those ideas or give me confidence in those ideas were, because you do have moments like where she runs up the tree where everyone's looking at you like you're crazy because you want to build a tree. And, you know, we had one house and it looked nice. And then we went and looked at it it doesn't really work. It won't work well. And then my producer was like, you want a house like this and you wish there was a tree right here. And I said, oh yeah, so that's what we're gonna do, we got to build a tree. And everyone looks at you like you're an asshole, and so much of directing is just having to, you know, have the confidence to say no, this is what I want, and I'll die on this hill, but This is the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
For people at home listening, there's a scene where a little girl runs up a tree and jumps onto the roof of a house.
It's great. It's great.
And I mean, you could have had one shot.
Yeah, you could have gone to HBO and just said, hey, you know, we can have a house and build a tree. Or if you really want to push it, then we'll find a lot that has a good tree and then we'll build a house.
Build a house around it. You know, yeah.
Well, you're choosing the cheaper option.
Yeah, cheaper option. Yeah. But it was still a thing where I remember Alec and I went to set and we saw these cranes and stuff in this neighborhood in Woodland Hills. And we went, oh, were they building a house over there? And then we go, oh, wait, that's us.
That's our tree.
Oh, Jesus. You know, and all these people on that, all the people on the street, they couldn't leave for work day. I mean, they had a park down the street because we had it all blocked off. And you're just going, all of this is because I want this in one shot.
You want that tree.
You know, I want the tree. I want her up on the roof, and I want it all in one shot. And because of that, all these lives are affected, and I'm going, and you're just trying to not feel bad. You know?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Bill Hader when we come back in just a minute. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos knows that for many organizations, maintaining a modern workforce of hourly, full, and part-time workers can be a challenge. This is especially true for human resources professionals working hard to attract and retain all the best talent. That's why Kronos puts HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. It's one specifically designed to give HR professionals supporting a blended workforce a whole new level of confidence. With Kronos, they have everything they need to tackle nearly any human resources challenge and are empowered not just to find and hire the right people, but to engage, motivate, and reward them every step of the way. Learn more about Kronos HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them at kronos.com/HR swagger. That's kronos.com/HR swagger. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe, private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love today. That's betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. Do you feel like you're sort of getting back to that childhood dream of being a filmmaker now?
Yeah. I definitely feel what that episode 5 was a thing almost more for myself to be like, okay, I see this and I know how let me try to do this the way that I see it. That's the kind of thing I always want to do. The fact that I'm in there and you see me was never part of the plan in my head. I had no interest in being on, not no interest, but I didn't think it was very good. I mean, it was not so much an interest thing. It was, don't you want to get like, you know, Ryan Gosling or something? You know what I mean? Like, why you don't want me in there? And then I think because of that, I'm a little bit more relaxed, you know?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Because it's like, if someone came to me and said, you can't act anymore, but you can direct, I'd be like, oh, great. But I say that, but then I would start directing and be like, oh man, I wish I could act. You know what I mean? And so, but I never considered myself, I'm not a like a theater kid or someone that just, you know, go. I don't know anything about plays.
Yeah.
I'm on set of it, Barry going, they'll go, so go upstage. And I'm like, what's upstage? Which is that like that way or that way? And everyone's like, oh, my
Which
God.
Is perfect for your character.
How are you writing a show about actors?
Yeah.
And I don't you know, at SNL, I mean, when I got that, I didn't have a manager, an agent. I had no headshots. I was kind of like, you know, taking classes or whatever. So I did kind of get into it in this very circuitous way. But then once you get invited to that dance, as you say, you know, I'm like, well, I got to work really hard to make this count, you know.
Now, anytime I have any SNL alum, I always have to ask them about their first meeting with Lorne Michaels.
Oh, yeah.
He, in my mind, he's kind of like this Charles Foster Kane character where everyone I encounter from SNL has a different version of him or a different story.
Yeah.
What's yours?
I was flown out. Megan Mullally had seen me in a show in LA and recommended me to him and changed my life. And I went out and met him. And, you know, you wait like 4 or 5 hours. I remember... got there on time and his assistant was really sweet and stuff. And then she went, oh, you want to go grab lunch? Well, I'm here. I was like, oh, he's not even here yet. So let's go grab lunch. So I remember going having lunch with her going, well, when is, and I just had lunch with the assistant. I'm like, when is he going to be here? And then, Megan Mullally's good friends with Molly Shannon. She told Molly what she had done. And Molly called me. Said, I hear you're meeting Lorne. And gave me some tips and said, you know, don't be funny. Don't try to impress him. You know, just be yourself. He just wants to see what kind of person you are. And that was the best advice ever. And I think it got me the job because I just wasn't trying to be funny. I was just nice to meet you. And he said, you know, do you know why you're here? And I said, you made him Lally. He goes, now what cast did you grow up with? And I said, you know, Phil Hartman was my favorite and Dana Carvey and Jan Hooks and Nora Dunn and all those. And he was like, yeah, love it. And and he goes, you know, I was on a boat once and there was a guy on the boat and he was being funny the way that Bill Murray is funny. And I thought to myself, I know Bill Murray. And that was it. That was all he said. And I go, oh, wow, yeah.
He's kind of famous for these strange non sequiturs.
Yeah, and I went, oh, okay. And then he went, when do you leave? And I go, and it was Friday. And I go, I'm leaving tonight, you know. And he went, well, you should stay and watch the show. And I went, oh, okay. So I stayed an extra day and went and watched the live show, which was Topher Grace hosting. You could see me in the background during the monologue standing against the wall with Mike Shoemaker. Like, wow, my God, this is Saturday Night Live. This is crazy. And then Lorne at the after party said, well, we'll come to LA, watch you perform. And I went, okay. And so I did a show with my sketch group for Lorne. We blew the roof off the place. It went great. And then Lorne said afterwards, it was a hot audience. I go, yeah. And he goes, were those all your friends? And I go, well, yeah. And he goes, all right. Well, that's not a good barometer. You got to come to New York where no one knows you. So I came to New York. We did the exact same show.
Oh, you did.
But Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and all these people were in the audience. And that worked. Like we got laughs.
So you didn't actually have to formally audition?
Then I formally auditioned.
Then you finally did.
Yeah, it was a year process. It was like a full year of doing that. And then I finally auditioned and then I got the job. And
what did you do for your audition?
I did Vinny Vedecci, who was the Italian talk show host. It was him doing impressions. So Vinny Vedecci did Al Pacino, James Mason, and Peter Falk. I mean, real, as Lauren said, you know. I mean, you're current, which is great.
Yeah. No, but I love that. That's one of the best things about you is that, you know, you put as much energy into the big celebrity characters as you do into more obscure characters from like old Hollywood that maybe half the audience may know.
Yeah, yeah, I appreciate that.
Some middling political celebrity.
I always appreciate that. I think it's because I grew up like in Monty Python and SCTV and stuff like that. And it was like, well, this is what they found funny.
Yeah.
And I watch old movies. I'm not on social media or anything like that. So I kind of don't know what everyone's talking about. I'm not a fear of missing out type person. You're just drawn to whatever you're legitimately drawn to, as opposed to pander to somebody or I don't know. Pander is the wrong word, but
you know what I mean?
Like, I can't be funny unless it's something I legitimately find funny.
Right.
I can't be excited about a thing unless it's something I am legitimately drawn to. And I think it just reads.
Yeah. I've had Gilbert Gottfried on a couple of times, and he does so many impressions just like you, but they're always like Wallace Beery or Sidney Greenstreet.
Yeah, Sidney Greenstreet. Like, and
any person of like a younger generation is going to know.
Yeah, but that's what he grew up with.
But he does spot on impressions just like you.
That's what he grew up with. So that's like, you can't help it. It's like, well, that's what I grew up with. I don't know, you know, anything else. But then on SNL, I was able to do the stuff that was asked of me. You know, it's like Elliot Spitzer or whoever was in the news and
Carville.
Yeah, to do Carville, James
later
Carville.
You reprised on Documentary Now in this amazing version of The War Room.
Is
that show a good excuse for you to indulge the cinephile in you and just sit around and watch a bunch of documentaries?
I mean, I've seen all of them, so it is more of like a thing that it's mostly the stuff I'm pitching or things that I'm like a fan of. The most fun that I had on one that was a surprise was John Mulaney and I wrote one that was a Spalding Gray spinoff and a parody. And getting to do Spalding Gray was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I had never thought about doing it. And then I watched a couple of his movies, and we had a very, very, we had 48 hours basically to write and shoot that episode.
Oh, wow.
So I like just crammed Spalding Gray, and it reminded me of being at SNL where it's like, you have to have a Spalding Gray in like 6 hours because we're going to be live. And so you just go and watch him and try to figure out what the impression could be. And it was fun.
Yeah, you guys really seem to squeeze everything out of a nickel on that show.
IFC.
They have limited budgets to work with, I'm sure.
Yeah, but those guys, Reese Thomas, Alex Buno, those guys, massive respect for those guys and their whole team that they can pull all that stuff off.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of just give them assignments and then say, well, try to make that work, and then they make it work.
Yeah, and another good example of you doing an impression that, you know, only a handful of people probably know, but doing it so spot on was you did a spoof of The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're doing Robert Evans, who was like the producer of Godfather.
Yeah, he used to run Paramount.
Chinatown used to run Paramount. No one outside of L.A. is going to know him.
Yeah.
But I mean, but you could still appreciate it either way.
In my weird brain, I'm like, I remember when The Kid Stays in the Picture documentary came out, it was really huge and everybody knew that. Yeah. So in my mind, I'm like, oh, everyone's going to know this.
Yeah.
And then you play it and they're like, oh, you remember when I did Vincent Price? I'm like, oh, people are going to be really excited. And people come up to me on the street, I love it when you do that vampire dude. What? The old vampire guy. Oh, Vincent Price? You know.
Was SNL as cutthroat as people say? Because I always hear these stories of actors fighting to get screen time and currying favor with the writers so they'll write a sketch for them.
I think I came in, it might have been like that. I feel like when I came in on my era, we all got along, and I feel like Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler, and those were like the seniors when I went to the show, and the kind of feeling they have is just because this place is like the DNA of SNL is competitive, you know.
Yeah. But
the idea of the show is competitive. And it's like, but that doesn't mean we have to be competitive with each other. Mm-hmm. Like, it's already within the show. We all know what the deal is here. So adding more competition and like cutthroatness and trying backstabbing and shit to get on it. So I never really experienced that in my time there. It was always kind of, I mean, you couldn't help if you worked really hard on something and didn't get picked, you would be frustrated. But I never felt mad at anyone else's success or anything like that. I don't. Yeah. I remember when Andy did Lazy Sunday, and then I remember like one of his next shows after Lazy Sunday, he came out and got an applause when people came, just when he went out on his mark. I just remember thinking, like, not in a angry way, but just like in an envious, like, God, wouldn't that be cool? But another part of me was happy for him. I was happy for my friend, you know. I was like, wow, look at that, you know. Like, Andy's like, people are
that's cool.
So excited for him, you know. And so,
because I sometimes I'll hear these stories. Some people will say that they feel that Lorne Michaels kind of creates or cultivates that kind of Ayn Randian environment.
Well, I think he likes it when people are you know, I think he thinks people might work harder out of that, you know, but maybe he, but I could see that, but I think, you know, the head writers and stuff and just the vibe when I was there just wasn't like that, you know, it just, it wasn't that thing really. I don't remember people getting like mad at each other or things like that over work or, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, I understand at some point between SNL and Barry, you actually worked in the writer's room on South Park for, I think, a couple of seasons that were kind of spread out.
Yeah, I had 10 years I would go in and out of that room for about 10 years,
Yeah, and you say that you went there to learn story structure. What did you learn from that show?
A lot. Oh my God, it was invaluable. I don't think I'd be able to do Barry if I hadn't have been spending time on with Trey and Matt and those guys. Just the bare bones of story of how a lot of things are driven by emotion and a lot of things are driven by logic and a lot of things are driven by, you know, you can tell someone a story and if it's just ideas and kind of you know, a political agenda or things like, and it's not hooked to an emotion or something you've seen in life, it's really hard to write about it. So if, you know, if Barry, if we, Alec and I started writing Barry, like we should write about the inherent violence of humans. It would be, you know, this kind of patronizing thing. But if you write a story about a lonely guy looking for community, who's a violent guy and hates that in him, and then go, well, what part of you can you relate to in that? Well, I know what it's like to want community. You know, when I started SNL, I wanted all those people to like me, and I wanted so badly to be a part of that community because I feel like I'd learn more about comedy and being a performer and writer and stuff. And then this weird fascination that I've always had with my own anger and rage, and Alec and I talking about that, and you know, repression and things like that. And our thing is like, you know, the guy at the grocery store shortchanged us and we didn't, I don't feel I'm comfortable saying, hey man, you shortchanged me, you know? So my point is, if I hadn't worked at South Park, I wouldn't have known that that's how you get into this. You know, it's interesting when people kind of write think pieces about people like, oh, someone wrote this really great article called The Banality of Evil for The Atlantic. But
that's what, sort of what.
But we
Barry
would never. But we would never have thought of no about Barry about
oh,
the
it was
show.
About Barry. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
about
then,
the show. About the show. I'm sure it's a great article. I get uncomfortable reading stuff, but I thought, Alec and I never have ever talked about, if we'd started the show going, let's talk about the banality of evil, it would not be about banality of evil. Right. It kind of just happens that way. And, and that's what I learned at South Park of like, oh, don't put that in the foreground. Let people drive the story and real emotions and universal emotions drive the thing.
Yeah.
And then all those other things will kind of come.
And it's interesting because it kind of treads this thin line between comedy and almost noir
in a lot
of ways, which I love about it. Did you ever have any doubts that you were capable of accessing that dark side of yourself?
No, I always found it kind of interesting and fun. And I have a friend who's known me for years and she's like, I've never seen you angry. This is the first time I've ever seen you angry is while you're doing, you know, is playing that part, you know, and. But again, it's like acting. You get to live a certain life without the consequences of it. And so I could get angry as Barry as I would like to get angry at the guy at the grocery store, maybe, or you rage at somebody I don't have the nerve, or I would feel bad. You know, you have a massive guilt that like, oh, I just, you know, snapped at the guy at the grocery store for shortchanging me, and you feel terrible, you know, afterwards.
Has it been hard to rein in that impulse to always want to go for the joke on Barry?
No, we're the opposite. We're of like afterwards we go, I think we need more comedy in it. We always kind of underwrite all the comedy.
What did HBO think when you first pitched them the whole idea for Barry? Because if I just heard the pitch and hadn't heard the show, it sounds like it's a totally over-the-top, high concept comedy, a hitman who suddenly decides he wants to be an aspiring actor. Did you find yourself having to constantly, manage HBO's expectations and say, look, guys, the show's going to be funny, but we're not going to design this show around hitting comedy beats?
No, they kind of got it. And when I first had a meeting with them before we even had the idea for Barry, their first meeting was, we would love to do a show with you, but that's not a sketchy show. We're more interested in, I had done a movie called The Skeleton Twins, and they were like, we're more interested in kind of that. And
Good movie, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And I said, oh, I'd like to do that too. You know, they go, we really like your performance in that, and, you know, something in that vein. So I think, to answer your question, they were primed for that. And when I pitched it to them, I pitched them essentially what was the pilot, and like beat for beat, the pilot. Like, it was a 30-minute pitch where I just walked them through the whole pilot. And I remember saying to them in the pitch, this show is going to be violent. The violence is going to be real. The emotions will be real. The idea is crazy, so everything else should be real. Like, yeah. We shouldn't put more crazy on top of a crazy premise. Let the premise be nuts and then try to play it real. And I said, I think the tone of this is if it was like a Vanity Fair true crime story. Like, don't think of it in terms of genre.
Interesting.
You know, think of it in terms of like, this actually happened.
Yeah.
And we're telling a story about this crazy thing that actually happened.
Yeah, and somewhere I read that you're a huge closet fan of Forensic Files.
A massive fan of true crime shows.
Some of the detective work.
Yeah, the kind of people. And I mean, I just love true crime shows. Mm-hmm. I've watched so many true crime shows that like a lot of shows will have the same case.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It comes up and I'm like, oh, I know this one. You know, I will say though, for the record, I did watch the Ted Bundy.
The miniseries, the true crime doc.
The true crime doc. Yeah. Not the, I haven't seen the Zac Efron thing, but the one that Joe Berlinger did. I saw that. I saw one on Jeffrey Dahmer that they just did. But most serial killer stuff, anything having to do with women, you know, being killed or, or children, anything like that. I'm not I'm more into what would be like Fargo-y type of
you like that other
heist
show where the women are the killers,
right? Snapped.
What is that called?
Snapped. Yeah, I love it. And I think that's the reason why I like it, because it's not women being like, so many of those shows are, you know, you turn them on and it's like a woman was raped and murdered and you know, and you're like, oh, geez, it's so terrible. But I love things of like a woman hates her husband, so she hires a guy to try to poison him, but it doesn't go well, and that guy then sells her out, and just the characters and all that stuff I find fascinating.
Yeah, totally could be an episode of Barry.
Yeah, and I think Barry's tone kind of comes from that, where there are real stakes and stuff, you know.
Well, I absolutely love the show, and I heard HBO picked it up for a third season.
Yeah.
People got to check it out. Season 2 of Barry airs on Sunday nights on HBO, and don't miss the season finale coming up Sunday, May 19th. Bill Hader, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks for having me. That was fun, man.
Thanks again to Bill Hader for coming on the podcast. One more time, watch Barry Sundays on HBO. And be sure to catch the season 2 finale airing this May 19th. For more on Barry, including outtakes and behind-the-scenes extras, visit hbo.com/Barry. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe, private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kickass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Subscribe to Kickass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.